session number 24825, Real 2.
Sorry, you were talking about being on the Navassa.
Yes.
What was it like on the Navassa?
Well, a little bit of a shock because prior to this, we had been across to the eastern states and back by ship, and our company had travelled first class. We had waiters and at the dinner table, and everything was done for us. Our beds were made up for us. It was real luxury. We got onto the Navassa, and you could stand below decks at one end of the ship and see the other end. There was nothing except mess tables and hooks to hang your hammocks on, and there you were crammed into this boat, and if you all got in your hammocks and someone wanted to turn over, it would be just like a pack of cards riffling all the way down through the boat because everyone had to turn over. We crowded the decks, waved goodbye to the thousands of people on the wharf. As I said, it was a top secret. We weren't there. They took us out to Gage Roads, dropped the anchor, and the rest of the convoy turned up from the eastern states, and they all had 2 days' leave ashore. We had nothing to do out there, so we got together bits of string, bent hooks, and tried fishing, and at one stage our boat deck was just about covered in mullet. One of the other ships of the convoy who had been ashore the previous day had lowered the boats again to a bit of exercise, so they'd come rowing around past us and started to tell us what wonderful women we had in Perth. So they got pelted with mullet and any other thing that was hanging around on the deck, much to the disgust of the snotty in charge of the lifeboats. But anyway, that was just one of those little things, and eventually the convoy did assemble and we took off then to the Middle East. The first stop was Colombo, where, according to our colonel, we disgraced ourselves because, being Australians, we weren't accommodated with the British attitude towards the Indian population, and finished up with the rickshaws. I don't call them rickshaws, but anyway, the driver would be sitting in the thing and the boys would be having races up and down the street, and a considerable amount of spirituous and alcoholic liquor was consumed, and generally the troops did make a bloody fool of themselves.
What was it like heading off? You see the horizon disappearing in relation to this might be the last time I see that horizon.
Oh, yes, well, I thought of it, I was aware of it. I don't know if the others dwelt on it much. You see, we weren't what you'd call a sentimental person. The things that you could think of now, we never thought of then because we were going away to win a war. And the thought that you mightn't come back, no, that's not right. These blokes mightn't come back, but I'll be back. So that's how, I don't think we worried too much about that side of it.
In relation to heading off on the Navassa, you go in convoy.
Yes. I don't know how many ships were in the convoy. There's a couple of British battleships, big ships. I think the Ramillies was one. They were escorting us and a few destroyers, so it was quite a convoy, yes.
I understand that the Navassa was left behind because it was so slow.
No, it wasn't actually left behind, but it retarded the speed of the rest of the convoy. A convoy travels at the fastest speed of the slowest ship, and the Navassa's fastest speed was much slower than the slower speed of the slower ship, I think, and they sort of slowed things up a little.
Mm. What precautions were taken on board in relation to heading off?
Oh, well, we're all issued with a life belt. We were all given lifeboat stations, and there was practice alarms and things of that nature, so we were drilled accordingly. Most of the time we walked around just a pair of shorts on. You wouldn't wear, didn't need to wear anything else, and we all got a bronze bilio on. And we settled into a routine. I know our platoon used to practice sending the Morse code on a couple of buzzers we had there. Other platoons used to do a bit of light duel, but you couldn't do any concerted physical effort because the superstructure of the old Navassa was not too strong. And if you got all the troops running around doing boisterous games, it was dangerous. Well, the theory was it could have folded up. So there wasn't a great deal of physical activity on the boat. Two up was played, crown on the anchor and all that sort of thing, but not a great deal of physical activity.
Was there any briefings on where or what was expected of you once you got to your own destination?
No, not really. No, we used to have there was really no official briefing. We were given, as I say, lifeboat drill. Everyone had a life jacket. But as to where we were going, what we were doing, well, I don't think they knew either at that stage. Because one brigade which followed us finished up in England. They went direct to England. So, and we were in Palestine at the time. And so I would say that they weren't too sure where we were going to go either.
You mentioned being in Colombo. What was it like to actually see another strange part of the world?
Oh, well, first thing you do, of course, you look at the local population, you say, oh, wogs, because we're British and all that sort of thing. And it was a new country, things that you would expect because you'd seen it on the movies and you'd been taught about it at school, but there it was straight in front of you, and it was a little different. The smells were different, the atmosphere was different, the humidity was different. We'd never struck anything like that. And the labour techniques too, when after shore leave, we returned to the Navassa, and it was covered in coal dust because down on the water's edge there was a barge loaded with bags of coal, and there was a line of natives passing the coal up instead of a conveyor belt, they were handing it from one to another, and there was coal everywhere, coal dust all over the ship. That was something you don't expect to see, a line of coolies, I suppose they would be called, handing along stuff of that nature.
But the adventure that you've been hoping for?
Oh, yes. Well, at that stage, we were, I use that expression too much, we were all young, very, to my mind, very ignorant, and everything was new and exciting. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Things were entirely new, scenery was different, buildings were different, trams shaped different, everything else. Therefore, it was all part of it being alive, and just the magic of it all.
People talk of this sort of tourists on a holiday almost.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were called 5 bob a day tourists.
Who by?
Oh, everyone, yeah, including ourselves. Yeah.
Some people called you 5 bob a day killers, I understand.
Oh, well, they could call you any damn thing, I suppose. You could call us 5 bob a day heroes. Depends on what your mental attitude was.
Did you ever hear of people against the war? Those people that might have called you 5 bob a day murderers or killers?
No, quite frankly, I hadn't. No, I don't recollect any parades or demonstrations against the war at all. Not to my knowledge, anyway. No.
So here you are in Colombo. Have you got a Gold Face Hotel?
I don't know where we went. I think we just trickled around all day. We only had a day's leave. We probably just wandered around like lost sheep, trying to look important and come back to the boat at the end of the day. That's about all it was.
So you're heading off into Navassa, continues on your way?
Yes, we get away. Well, the convoy eventually gets underway again. We went through past Aden. There was no leave at Aden. And we got off at Kantara, where the light horse had got off 20 years before, sort of thing. Same places, same sort of thing. We had a good feed there, though. They had a terrific feed for a whole shipload of us, and it was enjoyable.
What was the food like on board the Navassa?
Oh, very basic, and very stew, I think. I can't recollect exactly what it all was, but it was potatoes and stew of this nature, but it was sufficient, put it that way. I would classify it as being basic, but sufficient.
So you're taken off board
at Kantara.
El Kantara. You were fed there. What were you fed?
I don't know. Probably the British Navy or someone had set up headquarters because they knew troops would be going in and out of El Kantara for the rest of the war, sort of thing. And It was all I can remember was we had a damn good wholesome meal there. We just, what was in it, I couldn't tell you.
What were your impressions of Alcantara?
Well, we got in there at night, at the end of the day, and we were on a train on our way up to Palestine, so I wouldn't know.
Tell us about the trip on the train.
Oh, well, that was quite orderly, just went across desert country, but there was a map on the train pointing out former battlefields and so on, and there you were. Well, I know my dad had been all through there. There was this funny feeling about seeing something of your father. And there was I can't exactly remember how long the journey was either, but it did have these maps which impressed me, put it that way. They stick in my mind, of all the old battlefields and so on.
What was morale on board the train?
Oh, well, morale was high as a regimental entity. Morale was high all the way through it, yes. Not necessarily just on the train, all the way through our training in the eastern states and so on. It's a system they had. They built up that sense of morale and esprit de corps right from the word go, which was very necessary and very strong.
How were the officers seen?
Oh, quite good. They were... a lot of them were promoted from militia units. We knew them in the militia. A lot of them, well, from my point of view, Perth was a good country town. Everyone just about knew everybody. So when the officers were promoted to officers, you still knew them as Bill or Charlie or so on, but you wouldn't address them as such on a parade or anything of that nature, naturally. But there was a feeling between the officers and the men of oneness. No superiority amongst the officers. No, oh no. But they were the officers, they were the leaders, but they were part of the setup. They weren't from above the setup or anything else. They were all there. They had been mixed with the men, they'd been training with the men, and they were part of the men.
What about the leaders of the country, for instance, the leaders of Australia?
Oh, well, at the time, we didn't know a great deal about Mr. Menzies. His name was Pig Iron Bob, of course, so we had a certain amount of derisive attitude towards him. But a certain amount of derision that the politicians in our country is always on. I mean, that hasn't changed at all. I don't think we knew a great deal about the leaders of the country. I know we were formed up in the parade and stood there for hours for Lord Gowrie to walk past on a horse, and that didn't impress us very much. But that was all part of the routine, apparently. But never weighed a great deal. No, I never looked much past the colonel and the officers of our battalion and the company and so on.
What about your enemy? Do you know who they were to be?
No, I didn't. I knew the Germans were in the war, and I knew the Italians had joined up. But when we were in Palestine, as I said, I was very naive. I knew there was fighting around Cyrenaica and Libya, but I had no idea where they were. They were somewhere there. And because when we were moved up into that area, it all formed up, and you could see it then. But up until then, well, I didn't know where it was. And the countries in Europe that were being invaded, I had no idea where they were. Yeah, because we were Australians, surrounded by water, speak a common language, and...
What did the training involve in Palestine?
Oh, we were down southern Palestine. We were camped at Gaza. Yes, Gaza. And at Kilo 89. There's a lot of desert between there and Beersheba, and we covered most of it. We used to be in camp for a week and out in the desert for a week, and it would be real desert training, and you were taught to be tough and rough and rough. You'd go a week without a wash or a bath, you know, it was, and in the same clothes. So we were toughened up, and they got quite keen. Again, being in the signal platoon, though, we did have our problems. We still had no bloody gear. We still had Lucas lamps and flags and things like this, branded 1918. Telephone cable, well, you make sure you bring that back because it's in short supply. We can't leave that lying around the place. And that's the training is far as the signal platoon went, we had very little. We did eventually get it just before we went into action up in North Africa, but we knew how to use it. But I know, as I have mentioned elsewhere, when I went advanced into Bardia, I was carrying a Lucas lamp and a stand. I had two flags. I had a heliograph and stand, plus some cable, and I reckon they could have hit me with an anti-tank shell and it wouldn't have hurt me at all. Just a heap of signaling gear with 2 feet underneath and a tin out on top. But, and that's what we were doing.
What were the main signals that you were to learn? What did you actually learn as a signaler?
Well, the purpose of a signal platoon within a battalion is communication between battalion headquarters and company headquarters. So when you go, that's all right. According to the manuals we had, for example, when you were laying out signalling cable, you had to hang it on the hedgerows by the side of the road so that the vehicles wouldn't run over them. Well, of course, in the desert, there's no hedgerows and there's no little creeks flowing past and there's no trees. So you'd lay it out. And the first thing that would happen, of course, at the end of the day, the food truck would come up and, "Where's B Company?" "Oh, it's out there." And they'd put a wheel on either side of your cable and follow the cable out. Well, every bit of traffic that went out there would gradually bury the cable and chop it up, and this was what we were taught to do. After the Battle of Bardia, we had a bit of luck there. We got all the Italian cable and we could lay that out and just walk away and leave it, which was a great thing. And at one stage, was it Bardia or Tobruk? I've forgotten, but we had a forward company there. One of our smart signalers worked out if he climbed up the post and hooked into the wires up there, and his mate did the same, they could save laying out the cable. But the Italians down in Bardia were on the same line. They're having the armistice. So these humorous things did happen.
Obviously, you were trained through to the rest of 1940.
Yeah.
Until 41, the beginning of 41. What was Christmas like?
Our Christmas was quite good, in as much that the Australian Comforts Fund had got quite an abundance of Australian food up there. And before we went up into the Western Desert, we had the Colonel realised that we could be in action at Christmas time, so we had quite a big celebration of Christmas. We had 2 bottles of beer a man, I think it was. Plus there was turkey, potatoes, and all the wonderful things that we get, mutton as well. But we're still camped in the same spot on Christmas Day, so we did it all again. So we had 2 Christmas breakups or parties. But the food for these particular occasions was quite good. It had been bought up in quantity, obviously morale boosting and so on. But it was quite good tucker on our Christmas time.
Been there for 6 months or so. In relation to seeing the country, in relation to being on leave, what was that like? Where would you go?
Oh, well, from when we were in, before we went into action, let me clear this up. I think we were about 8 months in Palestine, and then we moved up into the desert facing Cyrenaica, and we were there for quite a few months also. In Palestine, on leave, of course, you go straight out to this Haifa. There was Jerusalem, there's all the sacred cities and all the sacred places that you could see, all the things that you're taught about at school, they're all there. You could have leave, you could see all them. You get a week's leave now and then, but it wasn't copious. And then also when we go into Egypt, and we're up in the Western Desert, or facing the Western Desert, we have leave into Alexandria as well. And they were, well, usual sort of, these blokes wandering around seeing all. Some people go straight to the museums, the art galleries, others go to the pub, and that just depends on what your upbringing or how your attitudes were. But there was leave, yes.
In relation to sort of being there for so long and still not really being in action, how did that affect you as well?
Oh, well, from my point of view, and I think for most of the signal platoon, you're restricted to your platoon, of course. We wanted to be able to become fairly efficient signalers as best we could, because we realised with a certain amount of responsibility. The rest of the troops, they were kept busy training. For example, they, as I said, we go out in the desert for a week and it would be rugged. In the camp, they would still be training how to use their weapons. When I say weapons, I'm talking about Vickers guns and Bren guns. We've got Bren guns there. We started off with Lewis guns, believe it or not, with 1918 branded on them. And so they got the hang of all these things, I mean, how to work as a platoon, as a team, and so on. Well, we were taught the same. Our training was a bit different because we worked in pairs. You'd have two men to a company headquarters, and you'd have a group back at battalion headquarters. So it was a different sort of training. But we were not actually a signal platoon, although they're trained in all the infantry tactics. They were not... what's the word I'm trying to be? We're not trying to kill the way the platoons were. We were there for communication. Although we did know how to handle ourselves and how to work as a team, our job was communication.
How were the enemy seen in relation to the Italians?
Oh, the Italians, well, they... we realised after the Battle of Bardia that they didn't really want to fight.
But up until that time, how had they been seen? Was there any kind of image of them?
Not really, because they're an unknown quantity. I mean, up until we come in contact with them, our knowledge of the Italian army was Mussolini standing up there and a magnificent army of tanks and cannons and everything else parading by. We had no idea what they might do. It was only when the... I think it was members of the Indian Army, some Indian division, had been up near Bardia for quite a while, and they were going to be, I'm quoting from history books I read, they were going to be transferred down into another part of Africa. But before they went, they thought they'd have a bit of a go at these Italians, and it was such a roaring success, that's when they decided, oh, we'll send the Aussies in and we'll clean this mob up. And then, well, we lost men, the division lost men, of course. No battle was fought without casualties, but in proportion, we did remarkably well.
In relation to going away to fight for king and country, what was the feeling that you might actually have to kill for king and country?
That never entered my head. And obviously, others had thought of it. And, okay, it seems so... callous and indifferent to say it now, but we were trained to kill. That's what you were there for. And men were trained to that purpose. It seems a horrible thing to say now in my old age, but that's how you were. And they were the enemy. They were going to kill you or you were going to kill them. And that was the story. It was the bottom line.
What were you being told about preparing to head off for Bardia after Christmas, obviously, January?
Yeah. Well, we were raring to go, of course. Of course we were. We'd been trained, we'd been working, 8 months or more. Oh, yes, hell of a long time. I've forgotten exactly how long, but near enough to 12 months we'd been in Palestine and in Egypt training. There's always training desert, and we just dying to have a go at them. And, of course, it worked.
So 3rd of January?
Yeah.
1941? Tell us about the attack on Bardia. What did that involve, beginning to end, if you recall?
From my point of view, okay, we arrived up there at Bardia at the end of a day. And everything's quiet, blokes were whispering, dig in, so you dug in. And we had a corporal who had been in the First World War, and I'm on the telephone exchange, and he crawls over to me and says, 4 o'clock in the morning, there's the biggest barrage ever seen going to open up. He said, I've seen some in my day. I want to see this one. You wake me up. Righto. So I wake him up at 4:05, I think it was, and he calls over. He says, it's happening any minute now. Oh, we're in our trench looking to the rear where the artillery is, and you can hear hell breaking loose. The sky lights up, everything. Can't see a thing. And we look around, and about 10 miles or so ahead of us, is the artillery lines, and we're about 10 miles behind the artillery, which is usually about 25 miles behind the front line. And we've been crawling around whispering to each other all night and digging in. And so comes next day, we're going to advance. The plan was, of course, they're going to break through the wire. There's a big anti-tank ditch around Bardia. They're going to break through the wire. Some battalions were going left, some right, and we had to move up. We were actually, I believe, the last battalion of the last brigade sort of thing. So the only bit I saw of the Battle of Bardia was eventually taking off, as I said, with all that signalling gear wrapped around me. Getting to the barbed wire by the end of the day, we'd marched all day forward, we got to the barbed wire, and of course by the time next day it was all over, so we never had anything to do there. But we did get into a bit of a strife at Derna. We had a pretty solid battle there.
What did you see of Bardia?
Not a great deal, because we were the reserve battalion, to my knowledge anyway, of the reserve brigade, so we never saw a great deal. We were there camped in the area. There were a few Italian ships in the harbour there, which had been blown to bits and ruined. There was a cruiser of some sort too that had been firing its guns at one stage. I think it was Bardia, or it might have been Tobruk. One of the beauties about growing old is you don't remember and you don't give a damn much anyway. But so
a lot of prisoners taken off.
Oh, in that respect, yes.
28,000.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, in that respect, yes, they just came back, and there's quite a few funny episodes there. I expect Katie Johnson's told you about a few of them, but I do understand that an Italian dispatch rider got a bit too close to one of our battalions, and a fellow, a Lieutenant Robbie, I'm quoting from a history book now, he picked up a stick and threw it and knocked this bloke off, and the bloke went crook at him because he'd been a market gardener in Perth and he was trying to get out our side and they're knocking him around. And I do know in our battalion, in the company I was attached to at one stage, the prisoners were coming out, and one of our blokes knew one of the prisoners from the goldfields. So, you know, it was some funny acts or, you know, peculiar moments.
Do you recall seeing them?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, there were thousands of them, of course. And, they're just coming back through your positions. That's all.
What do you recall of the sort of chaps they were?
Oh, they were broken men, of course. They'd been through a battle. They hadn't been through a battle. They'd lost. A lot of them looked had that shell shock look about men. They were a grey colour, of course. They're all dirty. And they were dispirited, of course, because the Italians are very emotional people at the best of times, and they weren't sure of their future or anything else. And they looked they probably looked the same as we did about 6 months later.
How do you feel towards them?
Oh, pity, because it suddenly hit me, oh, what's behind all this? See, in Australia, there was only three types of people before the war. There was Aussies, Poms, and bloody Dagos on the side. And which, of course, was a terrible attitude, because you realise now that the Italian migrants have turned out to be the best citizens this country's ever had. But in those days, that's how British we were. They used to walk along the street talking Italian. You think, I shouldn't do that. This is strange. I should be talking British. And, well, you've probably heard about the riots in the goldfields before the war. But outside of all that, okay, so I felt a bit sorry for them. I couldn't gradually begin to dawn on me, what the hell's all this about? Why are ordinary men like us doing these things to each other? And I had several incidents of this later in the war. But, yeah, mainly pity. Yeah.